1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. There we go. We're all done. Just double checking. Yeah. I think we're good. Just throw this over here. Yeah. There we go. Okay. We're good. Hey, everybody. Here we go. Look at your man. Two live streams in the same week. What the fuck's that all about? So, as you can probably tell, got myself some fancy new graphics. Not gonna lie, wanted to try them out. Yeah, I'm now an expert at this fucking software. I say expert, I mean I can make it work. It's very complicated. It's like learning another language, sort of. Not quite as difficult as that, obviously, but it uses its own language and it's got its own thing. And you come in and it's all, you know, people go, it's really easy, and then you realize you have to go on a learning curve. You have to go on this learning curve with it, otherwise it's just not going to work for you. So I'm still on that, I'm still doing it, but I think I'm making it work. So we're going to talk about a couple of things. I'm going to run through a couple of things that I've done this week that I think are interesting enough. And then I'm going to talk about what's going on in what happened in Peru. I know you're going to go, what the fuck do I care about Peru? Well, we should care about these places. Should care about everywhere and everybody. So we'll do that. And then I'm going to talk about, I know I said I was going to stick to international stuff mostly, but Van Morrison covered himself in fucking glory this week. I think it was last night. So I'm going to talk about that because I just can't not talk about that. It's just far too good. Like, share, subscribe, everybody, if you can. You got my links up on the screen here. Where are we? I've got to get that. So here we go. There's YouTubes. There's Twitters. If you want to share those now, that would be cool. Stick those up on your things. And I got Instagrams. I can't figure out how to get an extra wee logo up there. Give me a break. Like I said, I'm an expert at this stuff, but you know, I'm not a nerd. I've still a long way to go. Not an expert. Okay, so we're gonna, there we go, we'll wind the old theme tune down. Hello to Mick Conlon, String Ninja, and hopefully, brother, we're going to be able to gig soon. I know you're playing at Stendal Festival, and the Bonnevilles are booked into that as well, so hopefully we'll see you there real soon. Hope that goes ahead. Fingers fucking crossed. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. I may as well mention it now. So, we've got a gig. The Bonnevilles have a gig booked. There she goes. In the Diamond Rock Club, as you can see. Saturday, the 31st of July. That's like 20 days away. Almost 3 weeks. Now, that was booked. That was booked before, and we had to rebook it because the advice coming from Stormont was unclear, and it looked like at one point it was going to, if we'd have went ahead, it would have been illegal. So, you know, it was moved, and Derwin at the Diamond Rock Club there, he's gone to great lengths, great efforts to kit the car park out and turned it into an outdoor venue, and he's got lots of acts booked now for that. So we hope that this gig goes ahead. Hey, Davey Lennon, how you doing, brother? Yeah, gig man. Yep, we've got a gig. I'll just so it's the 31st of July. It's nearly sold out. There's a few tickets left. I think there's like a limited, like, so the car park, I think the official capacity of the car park is something like 500, but he's only selling 100 tickets. So there's a few left. A few people that have bought their tickets for the original date have had to give theirs up as well because it got rescheduled and they can't make it. And a couple of really, really good fans, really big fans, Johnny, is a guy, a friend of ours from Scotland. He's a sailor, and he's when he comes on shore leave, he comes and sees us wherever we play, and he had tickets bought for this, and he's fucking raging because he is a massive Bonneville's fan, and it's first gig in over a year, and he was very upset, and I don't blame him. So, get on to the Diamond Rock Club. I don't know where you get the tickets. There's the address, facebook.com/ the Diamond Rock Club. Live in the car park. I don't even know how much the tickets are. I think they're a tenner. I'm not sure. At this point, I'm sure you would fucking pay 10 times that for a gig. I know I would. So, yeah. So get on that if you fancy a wee giggy poos. And so that's happening. What else did I want to talk to you about? So this week, right, so the two things of note that I think of note this week. I finished this book again. I've plugged this before, but I'm going to give it another plug. So this is a book called The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists, and I'm sure you've heard of the book. It's a famous book, but if you can see there in the bottom corner, it's not a book, it's a graphic novel. And what a graphic novel it is. It's fucking beautiful. It's a fantastic rendering of the original novel, which is no mean feat. I mean, the novel is dense. I mean, fucking dense. And a must read. It's a must read for all good socialists or non-socialists, whatever. But the artwork in it is beautiful. The chapter headers there are gorgeous. They're all so. I actually have a connection to Scarlett Rickard, so it's done by Sophie and Scarlett Rickard. Sophie did the adaptation, the writing adaptation, and Scarlett is the graphic artist. So, and it's a big heavy book. It's a big thick fucker, like, you know. It's available on Self Made Hero, and it's £16, and that's fucking cheap. I mean, if you want to pay by the page, it's for nothing, and every page is beautiful. And it's a fantastic adaptation of one of the greatest novels ever written. And like I said, I have a connection with Scarlett because Scarlett plays Jerry, currently reading the novel based on your recommendation about halfway through. Brilliant, man. Fantastic. It's hard going, right? Stream went down there for a second. I don't know what's going on here. Everything keeps turning off and on again, and I don't know why. I really don't know what it is. But it seems to be coming back on board. Okay, listen, I'm just going to go with it. There. I can just see it on my wee thing there now. It just went boom. I'm back on. So I'll just push on as though it didn't happen. Where was I? Yeah, so Scarlett used to play in a band called, shit, I can't remember, but I used to listen to them a lot. I listened to their demos. This is before the Bonnevilles, and they were kind of influential and stuff in forming the Bonnevilles. They were one of the first what I would have called proper punk blues bands that I'd ever heard. You think I would remember the name since I brought them up, but anyway, so there's that. So try that. I would recommend that you read the book first and then get the graphic novel. I don't know, I've never done it the other way. That's the way I did it, so I'm not sure if that's a good idea or not, but that's the way I did it and it works for me. The other thing that I did this last night, so if I don't know if you can see this. Here in Lurgan, we have Shankill Graveyard. Let me see, get this up on the screen so you can see it. There. And Shankill Graveyard, this little organization called the Friends of Shankill Graveyard, and you can see on the screen there it says, aims to protect, preserve, promote the history and heritage of this ancient site. So, what that means is, I did a tour last night. I went and did a tour with my Irish language class, and we all went and visited, and I'll read you the little bit at the start, but I won't read you anymore, but I recommend you go and see it, you do it yourself. The site of what is now Shankill Graveyard served as a place of worship over the centuries. It began in ancient times as a simple double ring fort, the outline of which is still noticeable and is today an historic burial site holding the remains of more than 11,000 people. But it's not big, it's not massive. They're all buried on top of each other over the centuries. This place is sitting in the middle of Lurgan. It's thousands of years old. And you should see the graves in it. It's unbelievable. There's people connected with John Wesley, the Methodist preacher. There are people connected with John Hancock, a signatory of the American Declaration of Independence. There are the Brownlow family, who were original planters who came across from the north of England and beyond. There are people connected with C.S. Lewis. It's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. Now, locally here in Lurgan, obviously I'm aware of this place, but until I did the tour last night, I was not just as aware of exactly what it is that we have in our town. And shamefully, the local council seem to be determined to treat it with complete disregard, and it's very, very sad. So the aims of the Friends of Shankill Graveyard is to protect, preserve and promote the history and heritage of this ancient site. Second aim is security, to ensure the site is secure to prevent further vandalism, and then research and document the history and tell the stories of those that are there, and they want to do adopt a gravestone so you can would volunteer to pay for the maintenance of the of a grave. Some of these graves are going back 500 years. But when they're talking about the security, kids jump in at night and they kick the gravestones over. And there was one they showed us and said, listen, that was that one there. It's like a 300-year-old grave. Kicked a headstone over last week. And we were there, obviously, as interested local people, and our hearts were broke. We know about this place and we know about the vandalism that goes on in it, but when you see it, it's just fucking devastating. And the local council are dragging their heels. If this was anywhere else, as a few people said last night, it would be it should be a listed monument, really. It should be a heritage site. But it's not. And the local council are being real assholes about it. It's cross community and all that. There's plenty of Protestants and dissenter and Catholics and everybody buried in there. It's unbelievable. It really is an unbelievable place. So you should check that out. My wife is going to volunteer because they're looking for volunteers to help with a few things. One of the things that they need help with is for people to transcribe documents, to make an electronic copy of them, basically, so they can be read and researched by people that are into such a thing. So she's just finished an art history degree and she's very much into that stuff. So she's going to get in touch and volunteer to help them with their archive, and I think it's fantastic. So that's what I did, and yeah. So if you can, you should, and if you want to get involved, Friends of Shankill Graveyard, they're on Facebook. Visit us on Facebook, Friends of Shankill Graveyard. That's a wonderful place, and if you don't want to get involved, you should go and visit. Get in touch with them to go for a tour. It's free. We made a donation. Well, the GAA club that we do our Irish language class and made the donation. So, okay. Are we good so far? I know the stream broke down there, but I'm just going to push on. I'm going to type a wee thing in here. If you have any questions for me or if you want to fire anything up there, let me know. Hit me up. Do the thing. And I know it's coming up on my screen here that stream health not good. And then another thing is saying stream health is fine. So I'm just going to push on because I think it's okay. So, first article. So, last week, this is important. Last week, Peru, the South American country, elected a new president. Well, it's just this week, actually. Well, he's not quite elected. So his name... I'll run this little video first. And it's a news report from France 24.
Two controversial candidates separated by a wafer-thin margin. With nearly all the votes now counted from Sunday's presidential poll in Peru, leftist Pedro Castillo... Two controversial candidates separated by a wafer-thin margin.
I'll do it again, because it started quite abruptly. It caught me by surprise. So the two candidates, as the man says, you cut that in the middle of the art and at the start of it there. Wafer thin margin. But this guy come from nowhere. He's a proper socialist. So.
Two controversial candidates separated by a wafer thin margin. With nearly all the votes now counted from Sunday's presidential poll in Peru, leftist Pedro Castillo has cast himself the winner, despite election authorities yet to confirm the results.
De acuerdo al informe de nuestros personeros, nosotros ya tenemos el conteo oficial del partido.
According to the report of staff and the people that helped us overcome the challenge, which we salute.
A esta gesta a la cual saludamos.
His rival on the right, Keiko Fujimori, meanwhile continues to double down on unproven allegations of voter fraud, insisting certain ballots should be considered invalid, with plans to launch a legal battle.
First of all, the FIRSA popular requests the cancellation of ballots from 802 polling stations at a national level. These 802 polling stations represent about 200,000 votes. Once this cancellation takes effect, these votes will have to be deducted from the final count.
On Wednesday evening, hundreds of supporters of both candidates took to the streets of Lima, those behind Castillo demanding he be declared as winner. Others backing Fujimori, meanwhile denouncing the tactics of the left. Peru, which saw three presidents in a week last year, is on a knife edge. Large-scale political scandals, mass protests, and the severe impact of COVID saw the country post its worst economic results in three decades. Now just several thousand votes are set to decide its immediate future.
So there we go. Peru. Now, there we go. What to expect from Pedro Castillo? So I have an article here. Oh, shut that down. I'm going to read this for you, and so this is an article from America's Quarterly, as you can see on the screen. Just tidy this up. And it's written, so it's June the 10th, it was yesterday. So the election of a socialist by Andrea Moncada, fine Hispanic name, Moncada, very, very many famous Moncadas over the centuries. So the election of a socialist marks the end of an era for Peru, but the obstacles to implement his changes are as present as before. What that means essentially is it's okay electing a socialist to try and get the I mean that's hard enough, but to try and get their changes implemented are really, really fucking difficult. And then what happens is you tend to find that the socialists have to kind of succumb a little and sort of drift into the middle a little bit. Sometimes they tend to drift too far into the middle, and sometimes they go fucking far right, as what happened with wasn't Bolivia with the guy that was called Lenin, Ecuador was it, and he just was a socialist and then he got elected and he just drifted full fucking right. So, now here we go. So, even though the ballots are still being counted, it looks like Pedro Castillo, the school teacher and farmer who ran on a largely socialist platform, will be the next president of Peru. A virtually unknown candidate until surging unexpectedly to the lead on the first round of the election on April 11th. Castillo's economic proposals have caused alarm and uncertainty among Peru's economic elites, who fear his presidency would be the end of the free market economic model that has been in place in Peru since the 1990s. I'm going to talk about that in a bit. 1990s is important. Castillo's main promise is based on a simple message that he has repeated several times during his campaign: no more poor people in a rich country, meaning that Peru's resources should not benefit the population and not, as he says, the corporations and elites that have exploited and ignored everyday Peruvians. Ever thus. And the way to do this, according to his political party, Peru Libre, which follows a Marxist ideology, is for the state to take control of industry and participate directly in the economy. Excuse me. However, while this message may have resonated with many Peruvians and caused panic in others, it's not clear that Castillo will be able to implement his policies in the manner in which he has promised. In fact, the most likely scenario for the country's next 5 years can be summarized in one word: desgobierno. I'm gonna take another go at that. Desgobierno. Okay. He will face high levels of opposition from a newly elected Congress, which will be largely against him. Peru Libre won 37 out of 130 seats in the legislative, and there will only be one other leftist party, Juntos por el Peru, which only obtained 5 seats. The other 8 parliamentary caucuses are all centre-right or right-wing, which will make most of his promises very difficult to uphold. For example, Castillo wants to call for a national referendum to approve the creation of a constitutional assembly that would then draft a new constitution. His focus on the constitution follows one main goal: to change its economic chapter. As it is currently written, the state can only carry out business when authorized by a specific legislation and when it is in the national interest to do so. The objective then is to modify this chapter so that the government is able to do, for example, nationalize the mining and energy sectors, or to unilaterally modify contracts with corporations so that they pay more taxes. Those pesky fucking corporations, they don't like paying the taxes. His main problem is that our current constitution does not include an article that regulates the implementation of a constitutional assembly, so the executive would first need to present a law to Congress to include this mechanism. This would need 87 right, okay, we're getting into the weeds here and we don't need to know this stuff. Basically, you know that he hasn't got the majority in the upper house. Okay? So, you know, we've got 2 houses. In the UK, you've the Lords and the Commons, and Dublin, you've the Senate and the Dáil. Same here. So, and then I'll finish this out with a last wee bit. On Wednesday, Fujimori, which is the right-wing candidate, she has petitioned the electoral board to toss out more than 200,000 votes, in which her team argues, as you heard, with no credible evidence, are fraudulent. So that's the other challenge that he's got. So he hasn't actually been sworn in yet, although he's claiming victory. But it is that narrow. To think that it's something like 170,000 votes is the difference between the two parties, or between the two candidates. So a real test for Castillo's presidency would be if it can actually create a fair economy, or a fair economic reality, and more political inclusion for everyday Peruvians. Here we go. Nothing is more illustrative of the state's failure to do so when we consider that the COVID-19 pandemic increased poverty in Peru by 10 percentage points in 1 year. It took us 10 years to reduce poverty by that amount. the previous 10 years to reduce the poverty. So you can see the challenge that Pedro Castillo is going to face. I don't know if he's going to be able to do it. It's quite the challenge. It really is quite the challenge. But this is the thing. This is why this is why I'm talking with you about this. The challenge that he's going to face, although it's going to be from within, it's also going to come from without. And when I say without, what do I mean? You know what I mean. I mean, the CIA, say it with me, eh, right? So the CIA have never found a socialist government that they didn't want to overthrow. It's, and one of the reasons that they focus a lot of their attention on South America is because it's basically the neighboring region to North America. And it's called, I think it's called, I might get this wrong, the Monroe Doctrine, where America feels entitled to interfere in Central America and South American politics, because the way they put it is, it's our backyard, which is supremacist thinking. So I just, when they write the book of what the CIA has done, it's unbelievable. The things that we know that they've done over history. Then there's the things that we don't know that they've done. Oh, I did mention about the 1990s. The CIA started interfering in Peruvian politics in the 1990s. And since then, they've been a very right-wing government. And as a socialist, obviously I agree with Pedro Castillo, and I wish him all the luck in the world, and I hope he achieves everything that he said. Because the means of production, whenever you've got a rampant poverty, but you've got elites, making millions and billions in some cases, there's no excuse for that. And I just think I think there should be no such thing as a billionaire anyway. Nobody earned a billion. Nobody that existed earned a billion. Class, Mick. Pints in the John Hewitt. Oh, class. Good man. But nobody earned a billion. There's not a human being on earth earned $1 billion, pounds, whatever. They stole it. They hustled for it. They took it from the point of socialism. We're talking about the means of production. The thing is produced. Read this book. It explains it very nicely. There are a couple of characters in it, and that's the reason they're there. They explain these things in a much better way, a much more concise and tidy way than I can. The means of production, the owner class own the means of, they own the factories, they own the machinery, and because they own the machinery, then they get to keep all the profits, and then they get to give the worker as little as they can get away with. But if the worker owns, if the country, if the state, if the worker owns the means of production, co-ops is the thing that I am in favour of, well then, a worker's not going to vote his own job out of existence. He's not going to put the factory in China or Singapore or elsewhere. If the thing gets, if you have a factory and you're in a co-op, and you're working on a factory floor or a manufacturing facility or whatever it may be. Let's say you're making widget A, and then some foreign country decides to make widget A, and then they can undercut you by paying poverty wages and import those widgets into your country. What do? Well, what does a factory owner do? The factory owner shuts the factory down, gets widget A's made in the same place, and then sells in the home market. But in the process, he's made people unemployed. And maybe, which is the most, I think, is one of the most dangerous things of it all, they decimate communities. Towns just collapse. Crime goes through the roof. Poverty goes through the roof. Desolation, degradation, and all the things that go with it. But if you're in a co-op in that factory, you're working in that factory, what do? You shut that factory down? No. You go, wait, we can't make widget A anymore because we can't compete. So what do? We make something else. We've got the machinery. We've got tooling here. We can do this. And that's what happens with co-ops all over the world. That's what they do. Nobody gets paid 300, 400, 500, 600 times the lowest workers' wages. The bosses and the managers and the chairman of the whatever, they get paid more. That's the way it works. Whenever you hear right-wingers talking about socialism, they have this notion that everybody gets paid exactly the same. Well, that's communism. I've got no problem with a wee bit of communism when it comes to certain things. But in a modern form of socialism, the chairman of the factory or the boss or the manager of the factory is going to get paid a bit more than the guy that sweeps the floor. But he's not going to get paid 600 times more than the guy that sweeps the floor. So this, you can dispel that myth. And then it does away with the try to do away with the idea of motivation. That's the other one. They say you're only motivated by money. I am very motivated. I'm very highly motivated. I don't give a fuck about money. You know what I'm saying? And there are lots of people like me. You can't turn around and say everybody that worked through this pandemic, say in hospitals, those nurses and doctors that were putting their bodies on the line. There were lots of others in other industries as well, as we know. But let's use those because they are the best known example. Those people aren't motivated by money. They need paid. They want their money, for sure. But you can't tell me that those nurses and doctors going in there doing those brutal shifts, drenched in sweat. We saw the photographs, drenched in sweat, with the full PPE gear on to try and avoid picking up this fucking plague and dying from it. You can't tell me they were motivated by a salary. You can't tell me that. That's bullshit. No matter the salary. So, I digress, as is my wont. This is my podcast. I can digress if I feel like it. So here we go. So I googled this. This is fantastic. And one of the first things that came up was Wikipedia. And it was the United States' involvement in regime change. Now, I think I googled something like CIA accuse, something like that. And I would urge you to go and look at this. It's on Wikipedia. Wikipedia, there's issues with Wikipedia, I know. So don't be thinking I'm all in on Wikipedia, I'm all in for Wikipedia. We know that there's problems there. But there's a list here of, the article is called United States Involvement in Regime Change. And there's a list here. It's so long, it's funny. I'm not joking when I say it. We'll start from the 1940s, just. It goes right back to 1887, the first intervention. 1805, Tripoli. Oh, that was in the Ottoman Empire. Annexation of Texas and invasion of California. So you go right back there, right? You got to remember, California and Texas used to be a part of Mexico. Until they weren't. So we'll go back to, the 1950s. Because the 40s, it's just too long. So 1950s, 1950 to 1953, Burma and China. 1950, 1953, Korea. 1952, Egypt. 1952, Iran. 1953 to 58, Cuba. 54, Guatemala. 56 to 57, Syria. 57 to 59, Indonesia. 58, Lebanon. 59, South Vietnam. 59, Iraq. 59 to 2000, Cuba. Still ongoing, obviously. 1960s, Congo, 60, Laos, pardon me, 61, Dominican Republic, 61, Laos, 61, Brazil, 60, 61, they were very busy, 63, Iraq, 66, Dominican Republic, 65, Indonesia, 67, Cambodia, 70, Chile, 71, Bolivia, 73, Uruguay, 74, Ethiopia, 75, Angola, 77, Zaire, 78, Zaire, 79, Cambodia, 79, Afghanistan, 80, Poland, 80, El Salvador, 81, Chad, 81, Niger. You see where I'm going with this, right? This is like a list of the countries. All the fucking countries. Now, interestingly enough, Peru isn't on this list because officially they haven't this is regime change. This is not interfering in domestic politics of other countries. That's not what the list is. That's just what we can say for sure. America regime changed those countries. But the reason that I bring... You're going to run out of numbers. You're going to run out of years, dude. I know, it's serious. But Peru is about to find itself getting some freedom, as the Americans have put it, because they're not going to let this happen. Mick Hanlon on YouTube says, Ireland was pillaged longer than they've been in existence. Fuck me, man. Ain't that the truth? Ain't that the truth? The guy on the graveyard tour last night, he come out with a couple of crackers. I'll talk about it in a sec. I'll finish this. Peru is about to find itself. First of all, if this socialist guy ends up taking office, you're going to start hearing a whole lot more about Peru. But the reason that I bring this up, I urge you to take everything you hear with a pinch of salt and understand the source. If it's coming from CNN or fuck MSNBC, Fox News, BBC, these are state agencies, and these stories get planted. And we know now that most journalists these days are just stenographers. They're just reading out press releases from the spooks, the MI6s, the MI5s, and the CIAs, and all these state agencies, and they don't do an awful lot of journalisting. So we're going to start hearing this, because we heard this with Ecuador, we heard this with Bolivia, we've heard this with Leicester, Nicaragua, and all the rest. But these South American countries, we do hear, whenever the socialist gets anywhere near power, these are the sort of things that we hear all the time. Okay, we're going to start hearing it. I predict this. You're going to start hearing about Peru in a few weeks. You're going to see stories about this guy. They're going to talk about stuff that isn't related to his politics. It's going to be stuff that about his personal life, or how much money he hasn't got or has got. Or they're going to accuse him of all sorts of things. And when I went to that list of countries, I failed to mention, of course, Cuba. We know what's going on there. So you're going to start hearing this stuff. Just take it all with a pinch of salt and consider the source. You know, Venezuela, look what's going on with Nicolas Maduro. If you listen to the news about Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, people are starving. And they tell you that. They said, you know, there's food shortages in Venezuela. It's much like the food shortages here. You just can't get 15 different types of fucking... Sammy Wilson would have you say sausages. Would have us believe sausages. You still get sausages. You just maybe can't get. But whenever they're telling you about food shortages in Venezuela, they're not telling you about the embargo that the USA has put them on. They're not allowed to sell their oil. It's their natural resource that they rely upon to feed the people, to provide medicines for the people, to build infrastructure and keep the country running. America's put an embargo on that. The British stole gold out of their banks. £2 billion worth of Venezuelan gold was stolen by England, the Bank of England, Britain. Just, that's it, you're not getting it back. Done, that's it. They needed it, they never got it. So, we're going to start hearing these stories now. Trust me, you're going to start hearing these stories. Take them all with a pinch of salt. Onwards. Right. Right. Okay, so we'll push on. Mix funny. Mixing the John Hewitt, listening to this on his laptop. Being a fucking awesome bastard. Class. If you don't know who Mick is, you should. Mick was my first live stream I did, and I will get him back on because since I've obviously got figured a few things out about the live stream, I struggled with that first one. So, now, Van Morrison. Van. What are you fucking doing? I should actually pull up the Rolling Stone review of Van Morrison's new album. Let's see what comes up. Rolling Stone. There we go, because he mentions Rolling Stone in this. So, I'll just grab this actually while I'm here. No, go away, ads. I don't want to take out a subscription to Rolling Stone. So, as we know, and if you don't know. So we'll do this, bear with me real quick. Boom. Save as. I'll throw this up. Throw this up now. So, as we know, if you don't know what happened, you know what? I'll play the video first. Let me grab this. Files for podcast, where I went in there. There we go. So that's the review from Van's new record. But we'll play the video. So I have the video from Van Morrison's gig the other night in the Europa Hotel. I think it was the Europa. Check this shit out. Somebody makes a special guest appearance here. You're not going to believe who it is. That's not it. There's it there.
Robin Swan says, in his interview with Rolling Stone magazine, I was dangerous. Okay, well, if I can't affect any change in this situation.
This is at a gig, by the way.
I don't have any power, or my power is very limited to change this situation. Robin Swan has got all the power. He's keeping us in this over 15 months. All I have to say is, if I don't have any part, my part is like extremely limited, if at all. Robin Swan's got all the power, so I say, Robin Swan is very dangerous. 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 Come on, Junior, you want to do it with me? Come on. Come on.
Robin Swan is very dangerous.
Robin Swan is extremely, extremely dangerous.
Anyway, Brian,
this. No. This stops when we say no.
So, what you just saw there, if you're watching this, if you're not watching this and you're listening to this on the podcast, what you just heard was Van Morrison at a gig in a hotel And I don't like the look of that fucking gig. I wouldn't go to it. Everyone's all sitting down at fancy tables and there seems to be people eating fucking shit. Given off about lockdown. I'm going to read the review that he mentioned. There's it up on the screen. And the headline is from Rolling Stone. It's from the it's from his latest a review from his latest record. Got 2 out of 5 stars. Van Morrison's latest record project is a delightfully terrible study in casual grievance. His repetition sounds less like the trance-like mysticism of a Caledonia poet and more like a furious customer demanding a refund. In 1967, Van Morrison recorded 31 perverse one-minute ditties in order to fulfill his record contract. The off-the-cuff songs brimming with contempt for just about everything the young singer-songwriter in the young singer-songwriter's orbit, the 60s rock and roll scoring surprise hit Brown Eyed Girl established the young Morrison as, among other things, a first-rate troll. The first 5 tracks were titled Twist and Shake, Shake and Roll, Stomp and Scream, Scream and Holler, Jump and Thump, on Here Comes Dumb George. He mumbled those 4 words for a full 80 seconds. 54 years later, the artist who once turned the 9-second reiteration of the phrase "The love that loves to love me" into one of the most moving musical moments of the 20th century has turned to repetition once again. Have you got my latest record project? Morrison sings for the 12th time on his latest record project, the lead single of his darkly strange and delightfully terrible new album, Latest Record Project, Volume 1. This time, Morrison's repetition sounds less like a trance, like mysticism of a Caledonian poet, and more like the furious customer demanding a refund. The result is uncanny. The backup vocalists chanting Morrison's angry questioning back at him and his backing band riding a phoned-in jazzy blues progression will play the song completely straight as the 75-year-old singer barks with a caustic wink, "Got my latest joy I'm bringing." Despite its genuinely funny anti-social media screed, "Why Are You on Facebook?" Fucking wrote a song called "Why Are You on Facebook?" Morrison's new record bears a strange resemblance to the unhinged, rambling feel of a pandemic-era internet. More often than not, it's 28 tracks. Jesus, 28 tracks. Come across as a collection of shit posts, subtweets, and Reddit rants set to knock off John Lee Hooker grooves. The latest record project, Volume 1, he could have made Volume 1 and 2 out of 28 songs. I don't know why he just stuck to the one. But anyway, it comes on the heels of a strange, seemingly difficult year for Morrison. He spent the pandemic issuing statements that blamed government officials and the mainstream media for his inability to perform concerts and releasing surreal songs on the same topic, sample lyric. On the government website from the 21st of March, it said COVID-19 was no longer high risk. That's a lyric? Fuck. Morrison's latest album avoids such epidemiological debates, but the album is rooted in the same sense of grievance. At best, Latest Record Project is a burly, compelling mix of dark paranoia and petty outrage, so ordinary that it feels playful. At its worst, Morrison's album, with lounge roots arrangements as half-baked as Morrison's writing, conveys exactly what it wants to and nothing more. A laundry list of angry scores settling in vague financial complaints that amount to Morrison's very own inarticulate checking account balance disputes of the heart. Everybody's looking for some sign. This is a lyric. Everybody's looking for some sign. Meanwhile, everybody's drinking our wine. He sings in double bind. Another lyric. I got us tickets for the opera, but you complained about the VIP seats. He rails on no deed goes unpunished. There's also a song called They Own the Media. Oh. Oh dear. Morrison, whose voice still sounds as expressive as ever and whose sax playing provides some needed livelihood on his latest, has released 8 records in the past 5 years. In his older age, he's turned more like his contemporary Neil Young to recording as a more casual form of self-expression. He puts it best on only song. It's what I said then, just to make it rhyme. He sings in a pleasant pop number. Could have been on my mind at the time. It's only a song. Anyway, So there we go. Oh, there's more to that. I won't read the rest of it. I'm not going to read the rest of it. The result is a sometimes amusing, sometimes frustrating, sparsely thrilling, largely unlistenable collection of riffs and rants. So there we go. So that's the review that he was talking about. So why is this important? Well, first of all, as you can see, there's a couple of things there, right? First of all, Ian Paisley Jr. joined him on stage, and there was obviously no COVID worries. There was no social distancing maintained. Right? There was no social distancing maintained. Now, the media in this country, in North, have spent the last year and a bit obsessing about the Bobby Storey funeral from last year. And I know that might seem a bit petty to bring that up, but that's the truth. They've done nothing else. I mean, it's obviously a great distraction thing, but there's that, right? Now, someone put this up on Twitter, and this sums it up. This is the most important thing. Now, I think this was the guy from the BBC put this up as a response to Van's rants about the COVID situation and lockdown. And this is it. There's a guy called Gerry O'Neill. I don't know who Gerry O'Neill is. I just ticked this off Twitter. As someone else on here said, he lives through the civil rights movement in America, the Troubles, Bloody Sunday, everything, the Shankill bombing, the Ballymurphy massacre, Enniskillen, Oma, and he can't be bothered to write a line. Nothing. Doesn't mention any of them. But make him wash his hands and he pens these protest songs. And that's what this is. He literally lived through the civil... How could you, as a soul singer... How could you, as a soul singer, live in America during the 60s, eventually end up with the Marvin Gaye writing What's Going On, Trouble Man, and the other, I can't remember, the other one, is three records that has been described by the American black professorial class as the recording of the demise of the American black protest movement. That's what those albums, they cover that period, and they cover it in such beauty. And he's living there during all that, and he doesn't talk about it. He lives in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, and he doesn't write about all those tragedies, massacres, murders, doesn't fucking mention them. But the minor inconvenience of having to wash his hands, wear a mask and go into fucking lockdown, and he's sitting there barking at the health minister, that's what he's saying, Robin Swan is dangerous, Robin Swan is the health minister. Un-fucking believable. There we go. There's a nice picture. So that's a close-up of Van and Ian Oak from last night. And then we have someone else on Twitter says, this is Maria Leash, I think that's pronounced. The DUP have been banging on about a funeral for over a year, but one of their senior reps is willing to break COVID restrictions by attending a live music event. Hypocrites. The demonizing of Robin Swan is just one of the several shocking things in this video. And it really is. It really genuinely is one of the shocking things. And to say that they've been banging on about it, that's to under-fucking state it. Not they're banging on. I mean, they've gone to town on this. They're ready to collapse governments over this. Tweet number three. This is the last one. Joe from Twitter. I don't know who this is. Let me pitch a movie. A misguided Van Morrison and an intoxicated Ian Paisley. By the way, Ian Paisley was fucking pissed. The devil's buttermilk, as his dad would say. Ian Paisley struggled to highlight the dangers of listening to a health minister during a pandemic, all set in Europe's most bombed hotel, the Europa, at a dinner for the wealthy. Anyone want to fund it with their boiler money? Shocking stuff. So, listen, if Van Morrison wants to fuck his career up, hanging around with fucking half-rate the MP for Sri Lanka, half-rate politicians like Ian Hogue, that's up to him. If he wants to get involved in politics, that's up to him. Who am I to talk? I'm a musician, but I don't have a legacy. That's the difference. And I'm not a reputable person. Do you know what I'm saying? I have no reputation to fucking piss away. And you shouldn't have to worry about those things. If you do have genuine things to say, talk about politics, you should be allowed to say them, and you should be encouraged to say them. But hanging around with the likes of that fucking piece of shit, Ian Jr., and he is a piece of shit, going on about barking at Robin Swan, who arguably is one of the most is probably the most popular politician in the North right now, because he comes across as a self-effacing and a genuinely civic-minded civil servant, a genuinely civic-minded politician, unlike the likes of Ian Hogue, and certainly like although Van Morrison is not a politician, he certainly does not come across as being civic-minded. He looks like an old cunt, given like a male Karen, whatever that is, a Chad, I guess. That's what we're talking about here. And, you know, it's sad. I mean, I haven't listened to Van Morrison since the 60s, the 70s, I guess. But from the stuff that he done in the 70s. But there you go. That's up to him. But there's a nice little picture of the two of them together. So I'm going to finish this up. I'm just going to stick up on screen here that we've got this gig. So the Diamond Rock Club, Saturday 31st of July. There are tickets left. It's an early enough gig, so it's not like a 1 o'clock in the morning thing. Like, it's over like 9. So you can do plenty of other stuff. Just going to catch up on the live chat. So Mick Conlon says, to quote my old friend and comedian William Thompson, that's the most horrifying thing that's ever happened to quote my old friend, comedian William Thompson, that's the most horrifying thing that's ever happened in the Europa since it was bombed in 71. Fucking right. Davey Lennon says, never mind Van, Mon Italy, Euro 2020-21. Absolutely. I'm going round to the Woodville right now. Mickey Bartlett, Richie McGee, Lisa, they're sitting around there waiting on me. So, literally waiting on me. So, as soon as I end this, I'm out the door. Going to get drunk. Somebody sent a potentially inappropriate thing. Let me see. I don't know what that is. This is all, as I said, this is all new to me. So, I've got a wee message here that has been flagged as being potentially inappropriate. What have you said, you filthy bastards? Block links. I want to just let everybody say whatever they want. Hold potentially inappropriate messages for review. No, don't want to do that. If you say something dicky, I'll fucking just take you on. I'll just delete it. In fact, probably won't, because I don't care. So, this message is held. Show. There we go. Show. Okay, I'll go show. So, Andy, let's do a podcast where we talk about how we get String Ninjas of the Bonneville Supergroup on the pitch at St. Pauli's. Why? That'd be good. Mick Conlon, up a socialist musical sexy bastard. That's what got hailed for review. That there. Was it the bastards or was it the socialists that fucking flagged the moderator? Unbelievable, brother. Absolutely. Up a socialist musical sexy bastards. I agree. Fucking right. Right. We're going to do this. So, we're going to end it. Mick, Davey, everybody else that that joined the live stream, appreciate it. Do the thing. We got the gig. We got the gig coming up. Hopefully that'll happen. Yeah. As I said, you know, and if not, I'm going to be joining. Me and Ian Ogan, Van Morrison, will join a have a wee protest movement on stage at the Europa, eating wild venison and caviar, and Robin Swan's a fucking dick, cancelling gigs. I'm sitting here complaining, giving off about Van Morrison, trying to make a dick out of him, and I could end up fucking agreeing with him in about 3 weeks. No, I'm not going to do that. So there we go, everybody. Thanks a million. Happy weekend, and sure, we'll see you. Don't forget, next Wednesday, 7 o'clock. We're going to keep doing these things. I'll see you then. Toodle-pip. Bye.